As a young man, he was humble, not one to seek out public attention or recognition. His father was a prominent figure in society. He worked for his father and honored him in the pursuit of his father's interests dutifully and faithfully. He was also a good-looking young man, possessed certain natural leadership qualities. I'm tempted to ask our young ladies if this would sound like someone you would be interested in dating. I certainly hope you would want to learn more about him, because as it turns out, this young man was flawed. As he took on greater responsibilities and began to experience success, this young man began to change. Eventually, he would go mad and be humiliated in death by his enemies, a man bereft of his sanity and dignity. We can trace the beginnings of his downfall to one important moment in his life, where when presented with the choice of sticking it out and doing what was right, he instead made the case for disobedience. Well, some of you already may have figured out who it is of whom I speak. If you go to your Bible to 1 Samuel chapter 9, you will learn very quickly who it is I'm talking about. I'm talking about Saul, king of Israel, a man who made the case for disobedience. Verse number 1 of 1 Samuel chapter 9 tells us that Saul's father was named Kish. He was a mighty man of valor, it says at the end of verse 1. The marginal note says that means he was a man of wealth, of prominence, of influence. Saul was a choice and handsome man. If you look at verse number 2, it says, in fact, there was not a more handsome person than he among the sons of Israel. From his shoulders and up, he was taller than any of the people. And indeed, in his younger days, Saul was a very humble individual. In fact, in verses 3 through 10, in fact, in chapters 9 and 10, we find numerous examples of his humility. Here at the start of chapter 9, for example, Saul's father sets him out on to fulfill a task, to look for some donkeys that were lost. And we see Saul humbly accepts his father's instruction and begins to seek it. In verse number 5, when they came to the land of Zuph, Saul said to his servant who was with him, "Come and let us return, or else my father will cease to be concerned about the donkeys and will become anxious for us." You see a man who's very tender in heart. He's concerned about what his father will begin to think. He's concerned about his father's feelings. When his servant makes a suggestion to go and seek out the seer, in other words, the prophet, he's not too proud or uppity that he can't accept advice even from a servant. In fact, in verse number 10, Saul said to his servant regarding the suggestion, "Well said, come, let us go." So they went to the city where the man of God was. Later on, of course, he meets Samuel. And Samuel begins to hint, because God has told him that this is the individual who's going to become the king of Israel. And Samuel begins to hint at that to Saul. And Saul replies in verse 21, once again in a way that demonstrates his humility. He says, "Am I not a Benjamite, of the smallest of the tribes of Israel? And my family the least of all the families of the tribe of Benjamin? Why then do you speak to me in this way?" Later on, there's a public selection process where there's the casting of lots. And Saul knows, he can see that he's going to be selected, and he hides. He's not one that seeks the public eye. Verse chapter 10 and verse 22, they inquired further of the Lord, "Has the man come here yet?" So the Lord said, "Behold, he is hiding himself by the baggage." That's just a funny picture to me. Here's this guy that's taller than everyone else, hiding in the baggage. But again, he had a lowly opinion of himself, at least when he was young. Then later on in chapter 11, after his selection as king, he demonstrates kingly qualities in the defeat of the Ammonites. When Saul learns what Nahash the Ammonite has proposed to do to the men of Jabesh-Gilead, verse number 6 says, "And the Spirit of God came upon Saul mightily when he heard these words, and he became very angry. He took a yoke of oxen and cut them in pieces and sent them throughout the territory of Israel by the hand of messengers, saying, whoever does not come out after Saul and after Samuel, so it shall be done to his oxen. And the dread of the Lord fell on the people, and they came out as one man. Here's an individual who not only is humble, but is able to mobilize the people, to lead the people. And then later on in chapter 11, after the great victory over the Ammonites, he does something else that's very kingly. There were those who had doubted Saul's ability to lead. In verse number 12, the people wanted to execute justice upon them. The people said to Samuel, who is he that said, shall Saul reign over us? Bring them in that we may put them to death. But Saul said, not a man shall be put to death this day. For today the Lord has accomplished deliverance in Israel. Everything was going well for this newly selected king. He was popular. He showed great leadership potential. And of course, he was officially then, in chapter 11, made king in Gilgal. But that brings us to our text for this evening. Because here comes the first great test for this newly chosen king. In verses 1 through 4, we find Saul attacking a garrison of the Philistines. In fact, his son Jonathan led that attack. Verse 3 of chapter 13, Jonathan smote the garrison of the Philistines that was in Geba, and the Philistines heard of it. Then Saul blew the trumpet throughout the land, saying, let the Hebrews hear. Well, this, of course, did not make the Philistines happy at all. Verse 4, all Israel heard the news that Saul had smitten the garrison of the Philistines, and also that Israel had become odious to the Philistines. The people were then summoned to Saul at Gilgal. But then notice with me, verse number 5, as the Philistines make a massive display of force, they assemble their forces together in an impressive way. Get the numbers. Verse 5 of chapter 13. Now the Philistines assembled to fight with Israel. 30,000 chariots. There are accounts where you'll read people being scared that they have to take on 600 chariots. This is 50 times that. 30,000 chariots. Can you get that picture? I should have looked up the capacity of Lucas Oil. That would probably stand to be almost half of the capacity, and they're all in chariots. How about this? 6,000 horsemen. If you've ever watched Lord of the Rings, I can't help but think of that scene at the end of Two Towers where all of these horses come riding down the hill, an impressive display of force. And then notice this, and people like the sand which is on the seashore in abundance. Can you see them walking out and seeing this force assembled to fight with them? Now the plan was for Samuel to come to Gilgal within an appointed time, 7 days to be exact, to offer sacrifices and to seek God's guidance. And it seems evident that that was kind of the standing arrangement that Saul and Samuel had. You can make the case that this approach was taken more than once here in the book of 1 Samuel. And it was commanded by God, in fact. Verse 8, he waited 7 days according to the appointed time set by Samuel. But as we read on, we understand that Saul ultimately chose not to obey. It says, Samuel did not come to Gilgal, and the people were scattering from him. So Saul said, bring to me the burnt offering and the peace offerings. And he offered the burnt offering. As soon as he finished offering the burnt offering, behold, Samuel came. And Saul went out to meet him and to greet him. Skip down to verse 13. Here's Samuel's response to Saul. You have acted foolishly. You have not kept the commandment of the Lord your God, which he commanded you. For now the Lord would have established your kingdom over Israel forever, but now your kingdom shall not endure. Saul chose to disobey. And when called upon it, as we're going to read tonight, he presented his case to Samuel, his case for disobedience. I think we find it rather easy in general to analyze this text and to see how and why Saul went wrong. But I'm not so sure, brethren, that we always gain the lessons from these accounts that we should. In the text that Drew read in 1 Corinthians chapter 10, verses 11 and 12, we are admonished to remember Old Testament history and the examples of disobedience as a warning to us. Let's read that again. Now these things happened to them as an example, and they were written for our instruction, upon whom the ends of the ages have come. Therefore, let him who thinks he stands... What's the admonition? Take heed so that he does not fall. The Old Testament, brothers and sisters, instructs in important principles that Christians of any age can take, can understand, and apply. And that's very simply what we want to see from this text tonight, in which Saul makes the case for disobedience. We want to consider this text on three different levels. Consider with me, to start out, the rationale that Saul offered to Samuel. I want to say something. I want you to hear me carefully on this. I believe from a human perspective, there's the part that you underscore, there's the qualifier for what's about to come. I believe from a human perspective, Saul offered a very plausible explanation of why he did what he did. I get the impression that he thought about this long and hard and had considered all of the pros and cons before deciding upon a course of action. Saul here gives three reasons in verses 11 and 12. Let's read those verses first. Samuel said, "What have you done?" And Saul said, "Because I saw that the people were scattering from me, and that you did not come within the appointed days, and that the Philistines were assembling at Michmash. Therefore I said, now the Philistines will come down against me at Gilgal, and I have not asked the favor of the Lord. So I forced myself and offered the burnt offering." Notice first that he gives reason number one, that the people were scattering from me. And indeed, when we look at the text, that's exactly what was happening. Many of them were hiding in various places. Others crossed the Jordan to get away, and those who were left were scared to death. Verse 6, "The men of Israel saw that they were in a strait. The people hid themselves in caves and thickets and cliffs and cellars and pits. Also some of the Hebrews crossed the Jordan into the land of Gad and Gilead. As for Saul, he was still in Gilgal." Now you notice that. Everyone else is leaving. Where's Saul? He's right where he should be, at least so far. "And all the people followed him trembling." Now, when it says all the people, you go down to verse 15 and you learn just exactly how many men were left with him by the time Samuel showed up. Verse 15, "Samuel arose, went up from Gilgal to Gibeah of Benjamin, and Saul numbered the people who were present with him, about 600 men." Now, do you remember the numbers that the Philistines had that we just looked at in verse number 5? 30,000 chariots and 6,000 horsemen and people who were like the sand of the seashore in number. Saul had 600 guys left. Listen, he held out that long. Saul did not arrive, it's evident to me, he did not arrive at this decision hastily. He waited all 7 days before disobeying. He waited until he thought he could wait no longer before, in his words, forcing himself and offering the burnt offering. Now, I'm presenting it this way for a purpose. This is from a human perspective. Second reason he gives. He says to Samuel, "You did not come within the appointed days." Here's an example of where he was just factually wrong. Actually, Samuel did come. As soon as Saul offered the burnt offering, who shows up? Verse 10. Samuel shows up. It's the seventh day. He did come within the appointed time. But it was no doubt very late on the seventh day, down to the very last moments before Samuel showed up. Once again, Saul reached the point where he thought he could wait no longer. And then the third reason that he gives is what we've already talked about. The Philistines themselves, he says, they're assembled at Michmash. The enemy was growing stronger, becoming more organized and prepared to wage war. And as we've noted, they posed overwhelming numbers. Let me stop and ask you, what do you think about the case Saul made? Remember what I said, it's easy for us to sit back, kind of just analyze this text, well, Saul obviously did what was wrong. Then you put yourself in his place. And yes, by the way, he did absolutely do what was wrong. But my question is, would I have waited as long as he did? Do you think Saul did the best he could? Let me pose it that way. He waited 7 days according to the appointed time said by Samuel. Notice that in verse 8. He waited 7 days according to the appointed time set by Samuel. I think if this were a criminal trial in this country, Saul would have his pick of just about any defense attorney that he... I mean, he was the king. He could buy any attorney that he wanted. And I dare say that if a public opinion poll were taken, if this had happened today, a vast majority of the people would say that they believe Saul's action were reasonable given the circumstances. There's just one problem with that. This wasn't decided based on a poll, was it? The case wasn't decided in an American court of law. It was decided in the mind of God. And that leads us to the second observation from this text. After considering the rationale Saul offered, we next need to consider the result of all of this. The verdict from God through Samuel was swift and decisive. And I think if we're honest, it's very challenging to us. Verse 13 again. Samuel said to Saul, first thing, you have acted foolishly. He didn't say, well, Saul, you probably didn't make the best choice. He didn't say, Saul, you didn't just probably exercise the best judgment here. I probably wouldn't have handled it quite like you did. He didn't sugarcoat it, did he? You have acted foolishly. The latter part of verse 13, the latter half of verse 14, we find sentencing taking place. End of verse 13, or actually, he says, you have not kept the commandment. We'll get to the last part of verse 13 in a second. After he says, you have acted foolishly, notice what he says. Bottom line, you have not kept the commandment of the Lord your God. End of verse 14. You have not kept what the Lord commanded you. God was not interested in rationale. God was very bottom line, wasn't he? Someone says, well, that's not fair. Well, someone will have to take that up with God. The bottom line was that Saul failed to honor God's command. Nothing else, no matter how good it seemed from a human perspective, could trump that. Agreed? Nothing else could trump that. Saul had failed to remember that it was by God's divine appointment that he was king in the first place, and that it was his priority, his foremost priority, to show allegiance to God. Not to his duty as king or to the will of the people or to any other thing. His first priority was to honor God's will. And then we see, as we alluded to a moment ago, the judgment being rendered. The end of verse 16. I'm sorry, verse 13. Get this verse right in a second. End of verse 13. Samuel says, for now the Lord would have established your kingdom over Israel forever. Verse 14. But now your kingdom shall not endure. The Lord has sought out for himself a man after his own heart, and the Lord has appointed him as ruler over his people. Tremendous consequence. Saul's household would lose the throne. His descendants would never sit on the throne. Saul would lose his rule. It would be given to another man, one whose heart's greatest affections were centered on honoring God and on keeping his will. Might just kind of observe, that's the difference between David and Saul, isn't it? Wasn't it Saul sinned and David never sinned? It was that David's heart was set ultimately on honoring God and glorifying God. As good as the rationale might have seemed to Saul, it didn't meet God's expectations, did it? And I'll tell you, unfortunately, Saul never learned his lesson. He continued to make this same mistake over and over again, worshiping his own will over God's. Remember what happened two chapters later in chapter 15? God told Saul to go and utterly destroy the Amalekites. What did that mean? Man, woman, child, animals, every living thing that they had. Did he do that? Of course not. And notice the emphasis that Saul places on his own will over God's. He's lost his humility, and now he's become what one preacher has described as the I man. He's all about himself. 1 Samuel 15, verse 11, Saul says, I regret that I have made Saul king. I'm sorry, God says to Samuel, I regret that I have made Saul king, for he has turned back from following me, has not carried out my commands. Samuel was distressed and cried out to the Lord all night. Samuel rose early in the morning to meet Saul, and it was told Samuel, saying, Saul came to Carmel, and behold, he set up a monument for himself. Can you imagine? He thought he was all that. He thought he had done what God said. Had he? No. Then it comes down, and Samuel's interacting with Saul, points out once again his disobedience. Verse 22, Samuel said, has the Lord as much delight in burnt offerings and sacrifices as in obeying the voice of the Lord? Behold, to obey is better than sacrifice. Why was that better than... Well, obey is always better than sacrifice. Why so in this case? God hadn't commanded sacrifice, had he? He said, wipe them out. Don't save some to kill me, to kill... or use as a sacrifice, I'm trying to say, you wipe them out. To obey was better than sacrifice, to heed than the fat of rams. For rebellion, that's what it was to God, is as the sin of divination, and insubordination is as iniquity and idolatry. Because you have rejected the word of the Lord, he has also rejected you from being king. As we alluded to earlier, Saul would go on to lose his mind, essentially, in his efforts to thwart God's will, hold on to his power, kill David, and he eventually died by his own sword in battle, his body made sport of by these very same Philistines that we've looked at in 1 Samuel chapter 13. So now let me ask you the same question I asked after point number one. Now what do you think of Saul's rationale about the case that Saul made for disobedience? It doesn't look quite so good, does it? Then I think the question that's begging to be asked is, well, then how do we apply all of this? That's why we're here, right? To learn something from this that will help make us better people. So now let's consider the relevant applications. And we're just going to select some. Because I think, as you'll see, there are a number we could consider tonight. I think if we're honest, this account challenges us more than we want to admit. We, too, have an enemy that can seem kind of overwhelming. In fact, a lot more so than those Philistines. An enemy who likes to flex his muscle, who tries to overwhelm us, just as the Philistines did with Saul. And there are certainly times when it starts to seem to us that taking a stand for what is right just seems like a losing proposition and just not really the best course of action. In fact, we may see more and more religious people around us kind of scattering, kind of beginning to give in to a fear of persecution and beginning to compromise. We see public sentiment toward homosexuality, for example. It's rolling in a certain direction, and it's not rolling toward God's word. We can find ourselves in situations where we become so convinced that we just can't do the right thing. And I'll tell you, the case for disobedience starts to look pretty good to us. And the case for obedience starts to look less and less appealing. Let's illustrate that. Someone's marriage is on the rocks. The devil has gained a foothold. He's starting to wreak havoc in their marriage. The couple is not speaking. Well, they are, but just to everyone else except one another. Her friends at work start to say, you don't need to stay with this guy. You need to divorce him. You can do better. His buddies are saying, who needs her? And pretty soon, they start believing that divorce is the only answer. Pretty soon, they begin making the case for disobedience. Why do I say that? Because of what Jesus himself said in Matthew 19 and verse number 6. Matthew 19 and verse number 6, where he says, "Therefore, what God has joined together, let not man put asunder." And so they separate. And then not long after that, one of them files for divorce. And when you confront them about it, they begin giving you all the reasons why they can't do what God says. "Well, I can't love her," he says, despite the fact that Ephesians 5:25 says, "Husbands, love your wives." Even as Christ loved the church, and I might just insert there, when did he love us? When we were lovable? No, when we were very unlovable. And husbands, were instructed, we're challenged, aren't we? Love your wives as Christ loved the church and gave himself up for her. She says, "Well, I can't respect him." Ephesians 5:22 says, "Wives, be subject to your own husbands as to the Lord." You see how the rationale begins to build, how the case for disobedience is made? How is that any different than the case Saul made? You see that? Let me give you another example. We learn from Scripture that it is God's will that all Christians worship together in local places, that we relish the opportunities to worship God together and encourage one another. Why do we do that? Because of the high priesthood of Jesus Christ and the blood that he shed for our sins that makes us one. Hebrews 10 verse 23, based upon that, "Let us hold fast the confession of our hope without wavering, for he who promised is faithful. And let us consider how to stimulate one another to love and good deeds, not forsaking our own assembling together, as is the habit of some, but encouraging one another, and all the more as you see the day drawing near." I want to say this carefully. I wish I had a dollar for every time someone came up to me and made their case to me why they couldn't be at services, or why their kids couldn't be at services, or why their kids couldn't be at Bible class. Now someone says, "Well, maybe you're talking to the wrong crowd." I get that. But you know, I'm not talking about illness. I'm not talking about the ravages of time and age that just make it impossible to get out sometimes. I'm talking about the other reasons why people miss services. And I would just ask, how is it any different than the case that Saul made? "It's too hard. I can't do it." Well, you know what? Saul had it pretty hard. It's something to think about, isn't it? And someone says, "Mark, you just don't understand," and maybe not, but I can make Saul's case sound pretty good. At least as convincing as some of the explanations I've heard for missing services. And then let me turn this around, because I think, to be fair, we need to do this. Let me turn this around and say that the same applies when we make the case for not having the tough conversations with erring Christians that Jesus teaches us to have. It could be on a personal level. Matthew chapter 18 and verse 15, very challenging thing that Jesus said. He says, "If your brother sins against you," Matthew 18 and verse 15, "if your brother sins, go and show him his fault in private. If he listens to you, you have won your brother." Boy, how we try to explain why we can't keep that passage. Why there's some reason why we can't do that. Or Galatians 6 and verse 1, "Brethren, even if any of you are overtaken in any trespass, you who are spiritual, restore such a one in a spirit of gentleness, each one looking to yourself, so that you too not be tempted." And we start making the case for disobedience. We start convincing ourselves that we just can't practice discipline the way Jesus taught us to practice it. Matthew 15 and verse 4, Jesus asked this question, Luke 15 and verse 4. He said, "What man among you, if he has 100 sheep and has lost one of them, does not leave the 99 in the open pasture and go after the one which is lost until he finds it?" What's the Lord's command implied there? Lost sheep need to be rescued. You get the feeling we could go on? We can consider, there were others I considered putting in the lesson, but for time's sake, I decided not to. But here's the bottom line. I believe the Bible is very clear. And if you don't take anything else away from the lesson, take this point. There is never a good case for disobedience. There's never a good case to be made to disobey God. Now, it could be difficult, absolutely, but it is never impossible to obey. We could have gone to many other texts tonight. In fact, we already kind of went to one, right? 1 Samuel 15, another example of Saul kind of making the case for disobedience. We could have looked at Nadab and Abihu in Leviticus chapter 10. Of course, we don't really know what their rationale was. They died before they could explain themselves. Or we could go to 2 Samuel chapter 6 and moving the ark. Maybe your mind went there tonight. Uzzah. We could make his case sound pretty convincing, couldn't we? But the bottom line, though, goes back to our text in 1 Samuel chapter 13. The bottom line's the same if we choose to obey. 1 Samuel 13 and verse 13. You have acted foolishly. That's what God says. What Saul should have done is walk more by faith and less by sight. That's our lesson for tonight. Let's get ready to sing the invitation song. A song that reminds us of our need for God. Let's talk about what God says about salvation and just simply say this. Whatever rationale you might want to adopt or even to offer as to why tonight is not the time to obey the gospel. Whatever reasoning you might have for why you shouldn't obey the gospel, there is no good case to be made. You need to abandon that thinking and obey the Lord. That's the lesson for tonight. We need to trust God and obey Him. David trusted God. He understood that without God, he was nothing. Saul did not trust God. He did not wait on the Lord. He did not ultimately humble himself before God. That's the difference. Matthew chapter 7 and verse 21, Jesus says, "Not everyone who says to me, 'Lord, Lord,' will enter the kingdom of heaven, but he who does the will of my Father, which is in heaven, will enter." And there are people on that day, he says, that will offer their case for disobedience. Many will say to me on that day, "Lord, have we not prophesied in your name, and in your name cast out demons, and in your name performed many miracles? Look at all that we've done." They're making their case. Verse 23, "And then I will declare to them, 'I never knew you. Depart from me, you who practice lawlessness.'" You see, even in the New Testament, the Lord's very bottom line, isn't He? Here's what I say. Will you do it? Here's what the Lord says. Will you do it? As we stand and sing.